Every month, Linda Moulton Howe puts together a series of incredible stories for you, and she's done it again tonight. We will look at crop formations. We will look at more UFO cases over missile silos and bases. We will talk with her about bizarre animal mutilation stories, and she'll update us on just what's going on with the hunt for the missing honeybees on Coast to Coast AM. All that and more, plus conversations with Linda on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight, a special night with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, can you believe we're going into November?
No.
My gosh.
This is the fastest year on record.
They are all zooming. You know, and we've lost Zachariah Sitchin. What a loss that will be, huh?
Yeah, God bless him wherever he is, and I am confident that he's out there somewhere.
Absolutely. He's probably with the Anunnaki now.
Well, wherever he is, I hope that he will be coming back to inspire somebody again, because he really was a valuable pointer, pointing in a direction of history and in translations of those very difficult Sumeric Mesopotamian script.
Yes.
That people need to look at and need to go to academic institutions and talk with academics about them, so that his work really can live on with people inquiring about the famous history of the Anunnaki.
You know, Linda, he never investigated crop formations like you do, but I bet if he had gotten into it with you, he would have uncovered them like crazy. But that's one of your stories tonight.
Well, he was very interested in crop circles and all subjects that were related to what appears to be, we'll call them pieces of evidence that link something else with an advanced intelligence to interaction with Earth. And it was last month in the coast that I did in September that one of the callers got a hold of me after the show. And I was so impressed with listening to his eyewitness account about watching a crop circle go down right in front of him in Pennsylvania that I wanted to share this in this very first half hour tonight as sort of breaking news, because there are not many eyewitnesses to crop formations going down.
Super.
And this, we'll call it the modern age of crop circle formations, really sort of began in the 1980s, and people in the rest of the world started hearing about them in places like 2020 and in big newspapers and magazines around 1990, 1991. And Lucy Pringle described in her 1999 book, Crop Circles, The Greatest Mystery of Modern Times, one eyewitness case. It was around 5:30 in the evening on July 11th, 1981, in Westbury, Wiltshire. It was another researcher, Ray Barnes, and he watched seed heads on a crop jiggle, is the word he used, as if shaken, and he could see the jiggle forming an arc, like a half of a circle coming across right at the very top, as if there was an invisible force that was jiggling all of these wheat heads, making an arc coming across the field. And then in only a few seconds, a section of the crop went down in a neat circle. Well, that was 1981 in July. So it was only 2 years later, at the end of August 1983, near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, west of Philadelphia. Another eyewitness watched in amazement as wheat heads also jiggled back and forth before going down in a circle. But he knew nothing about Ray Barnes in England. He didn't know anything about crop formations really being made. It was that summer, Pascual Galante was 37 years old, and he was studying with a Buddhist group at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. And one evening around 9 o'clock, they had had a meditation group, and Pascual was approached by a couple who said there was a huge crop formation near Lancaster, which was about 45 minutes from where they were at the college. So Pascual decided to follow the couple in his station wagon to see this crop mystery. And they pulled their cars off to the side of a road in Lancaster farm country. The moon was nearly full, so it was not difficult to see as they began walking up a small hill right at the edge of a farm. And the couple told Pascual that these big crop circles were right over the top of this hill. But before the three reached the top, what appeared in the sky above the wheat field stopped them in astonishment. Here now is Pasquale Galante.
Okay.
And as soon as I started getting to the top of this little hill, all of a sudden I was aware of some kind of energy, and three or four things happened simultaneously. There was a kind of a humming sound. The wind picked up a lot, and as the wind picked up, I noticed that the grain, which there was a field of grain to my right, I'm pretty sure it was wheat, but it started shaking back and forth. Then almost immediately after it started shaking, it started spinning. It spun clockwise.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, right around then, I was aware of this force field, this energy, and then there was almost like this ozone smell. When I heard the humming, and this is all happening pretty much simultaneously, and it only lasted probably 30 seconds realistically. When I heard the humming sound, I think I looked up a little, and then I saw the craft. And at first, when I saw the craft, what intrigued me was that it had these little portholes above the edge, and it kind of looked like what people would draw a traditional spacecraft, where it was wider in the center,
mm-hmm.
and it had little humps on the top and the bottom. There was lights all the way around the center.
What were the color of the lights?
There was red, pretty much red, blue, and green, I'm pretty sure. I know that there was lights kind of in a pattern, not straight in a row, but right below the windows, which I took as windows, but I don't know what they really were, because they disappeared after the lights went off. The lights were kind of going around and blinking. And say there was a belt that went around right above the middle of the saucer.
Right.
Some of the lights were on one line of that foot-wide belt, and the others were above. So there was kind of this triangular pattern, like say the two lights on the bottom and one on the top.
Were those lights pulsing on and off?
I'd say more blinking. The lights were only there for a brief time, and it was the windows that caught my attention, because they were like about, I'd say, a foot by 6 or 8 inches, and then they were kind of rectangular with rounded edges. When I saw that, I thought, oh, these are windows, but then they disappeared. They blended into the form of the craft, whatever the substance was, of whatever kind of metal. It had a rusty quality, but the lights were blinking more, but not real quick. They were blinking more slow,
mm-hmm.
but then they disappeared. And I tried to see if there were bulbs, and I wasn't that far from it. I'd say physically, it was up in the air. If I had to look straight up, say if you called that straight up would be 90, I had to look about 45 or 40 degrees. It was about a 40 degrees if you make a perpendicular from the ground.
And how high above you?
About 40 feet away to my left, and it was about probably 40 feet above the ground.
Okay, so you are pretty close.
Yeah, pretty close. Yeah, very close. And I got frightened, because I was hoping that the beings would shut off whatever they started, because I felt this surge going through me.
When you say you felt a surge, what do you mean?
Well, when the whirling sound and the wind and the grain started vibrating and the humming sound, I felt kind of a power going through me, an actual physical power. I don't know what it was, but it was almost like I was afraid to move, and I was hoping that it wouldn't get too intense.
Mm-hmm.
But it was almost like a cellular vibration, because I felt something surging, especially through my left side.
At that moment, as you are feeling this surge in vibration through your body, what are you seeing both in the field and in the craft?
Oh, the craft disappeared before the wheat totally flattened down. So then after the lights went off, the center, which was a little bit to my right, from the center, the bottom dropped down like a cargo haul. And it dropped down about, I'd say, 20 feet down. Pretty much looked like a traditional cargo hull dropping down, but it came out of a seamless thing. I didn't see any seams where it came from. So it was almost like someone's jaw dropping.
What was the shape of that space that was made when it dropped down?
Oh, pretty much rectangular, and it was dark, and I got a little bit frightened, like thinking, oh, no, I don't. I was thinking, I don't think I need any more of this. I don't want contact.
Okay, so you were afraid the beings might be coming down at that point.
Yeah, I didn't know what to think, but then all of a sudden, whatever it was, remote control, or if there was beings in there, which I didn't see, I felt there were two beings there, but I have no idea if they were really in there or from another ship that was kind of viewing that. But the portal closed up again. The bottom closed up, and then it disappeared almost immediately. It just dissolved really quickly.
The whole craft?
The whole craft just dissolved.
And was it a disc-shaped craft?
It was disc, but it wasn't a flat one.
It's not even faded. It was as if it dissolved in the air above you.
Yeah, it dissolved, but it took about, I'd say, about a half a second, and it dissolved really quickly.
And then what was the very next thing that occurred?
And then the whirling sound and that smell in the air got stronger, and the wheat was going more and more and more around clockwise. I kept watching the formation of the circle. It was kind of swaying and then circling each stalk, and then somehow they were going down. And when they got down, they were still circling, but on a different axis. And when they were circling on an angle, they were hitting each other, and some of them were getting entwined. And that's what I found intriguing. It was like somebody was shaking them in two different forces at once, and they got down pretty flat. And we went over and looked after, and they weren't broken. I couldn't find any of the grains that were broken.
Describe what you saw when you bent over to look at where the stalks were coming out of the ground.
That was the part that I kind of thought, oh, that's astounding. None of them broke.
What exactly are you looking at in the wheat?
The grains. I mean, they were pretty much almost all the way grown. They were 2.5 to 3.5 feet high. And each one of the stalks was probably about 3 or 4 or 5 inches from each other. Then we just looked at how flat it was. I mean, it went down to less than a foot.
Okay, and are you looking at a circle shape in the wheat?
Yeah, well, I was standing right on the edge of it. So, I mean, I was really close. It looked like a circle. I'd say that the diameter of the wheat circle that we witnessed, it wasn't that big. I'd say probably 60 feet diameter at the most. I didn't pay real close attention to that. It was the movement that intrigued me and how it kind of got woven. I would say these were two different forces, simultaneous forces.
And when you walked into this brand new circle, did it have any kind of a springy feeling, as if you weren't walking on just flat to the ground wheat, but as if it was raised from the ground a little bit so that there was springiness?
Oh, yeah, there was springiness. The stalks were not flat on the ground. They were between 2 to 4 or 5 inches above the ground.
Did you then look back up to the sky with the thought, oh, whatever that was showing us that it is the maker of crop formations?
Yeah, I definitely.
And George, even though this is one of the few, I will say, eyewitnesses who have ever even tied any kind of a disc-like craft in the sky, mm-hmm. even over a crop formation, I think that Pasquale Galante is describing what he saw in the August of 1983 in Pennsylvania, and that there are a lot of details in here that make some sense and answer some questions about the crop formations to a certain extent. And there may be people who say, well, if this is the only description of some kind of a craft in the sky, even if it seems to be there and then fade away and have all those remarkable phenomena of something that you wonder, is it totally solid? Is it coming from another dimension? What is it? That there have been, especially back in the early 90s, there were descriptions in the beginning, not of people seeing a circle going down with a craft above, like in this case, but there were photographs and people describing seeing craft over the fields, let's say in England. But there never was such a close eyewitness connection as this one. So I think it's been very valuable to share what Pasquale Galante is describing that he saw. And what is also interesting is he went with the couple over the hill. They finally leave now the circle that they watched be made, and now they go over the hill. And the second formation, he said, quote, it was vast. It was as big as a football field, which would be 300 feet long. The pattern was 2 to 3 circles that overlapped, and there was something like a bar design that went through 2 of the circles, close quote. And that sounds like the dumbbell-shaped patterns in the crops in which in the late 80s and the early 90s especially, that what were called dumbbells, which could be as simple as a circle on each end of a straight line or bar, and then that beam ranged up to these very large complex pictograms that would have a circle on each end, but it would have perhaps complex bars along a long single bar. And I have some photographs of this at my news website, earthfiles.com, some of the crop formations that fit into this, what we call the dumbbell type, and also a couple of really interesting illustrations that Pasquale Galante made of what he remembers of the craft and of that, we'll call it the piece that came down from the center bottom of the craft. And in addition to these patterns and the possibility of a force maybe made by craft that we have not seen much of and interacting with the crops, there is one common denominator around the world to crop formations, and that is the mysterious small lights that right. have long been associated.
Very weird, isn't it?
It is, and they may have something to do with a craft like this. That's the part we don't know. But people have seen orange lights moving in fields before, during, and after crops have gone down in patterns. There was one woman in August of 1998. She was up on Adam's Grave in Wiltshire, which is in England, and she's looking out toward Tosmead Copse, which is a lot of trees next to what is called the South Field. And she sees three lights show up. One is red and two are white. And there was also a moon, so she said that she could clearly see the crop, and she could see these lights flying over a wheat field, and that she did see the crops go down in a pattern beneath those lights. And the very next morning was the discovery of what is the now famous Magnificent Seven crop formation next to Tosmead Copse. And I've got a diagram of that at the Earth Files report tonight. So other eyewitnesses who have watched crops go down in patterns describe crackling electrical sounds. That has happened in Holland, where a Dutch teenager was standing in his house, saw a light in the sky. The light could have been surrounding a craft like what Pasquale Galante saw. It's not known. And then he sees crop go out. He runs out into the field and said that the soil and the plants were hot to touch, and he could smell a strong electrostatic or some kind of a smell in the air, and that there was a feeling of a strong electrostatic crackling that came from these freshly flattened plants. And remember, Pasquale noticed the strong odor in the air. And also in Tennessee, that same month of June 1999, a man and his two sons went to see a wheat formation south of Nashville and reported hearing sounds like static discharge. And one of his sons compared the sound to the snap, crackle, and pop of Rice Krispies. I've heard that description many times. And so you put all this together, George, electrostatic sounds, the smell of something in the air, cameras that won't run. And here, Pasquale Galante is describing something in a craft and watching a circle go down.
You know, we've been talking about the seven American military men who witnessed a UFO shut down missile silos. Linda has an expanded version of that story next. And our special guest tonight, Linda Moulton-Howe. Hey, by the way, Amazon.com has a steep discount on our book, Journey to the Light. It's in paperback form. It's coming out in November in paperback, and they're taking advance orders. So if you're interested, just go to Amazon.com under search, put books, and then Journey to the Light. We'll be right back with Linda, and we'll talk about the incredible story of what happened on September 27th at the National Press Club. Linda, we've been following the story you have to on earthfiles.com of the seven American military men who shared their experiences of a craft over missile silos, but you have a more in-depth story for us tonight.
And George, who would have guessed or thought that a month after that National Press Club meeting on September 27th in Washington, that on October 23rd, Saturday, just this past weekend, 50 intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles went offline at Warren Air Force Base near Cheyenne, Wyoming. And the two men immediately notified were Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Michael Mullen and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. And President Barack Obama was finally debriefed 3 days later on October 26th. And the summary in this past week has ranged from engineers saying that, quote, the Launch Control Center computer began to ping out of sequence, resulting in a surge of noise through the system. When I sent that sentence and this paragraph to Bob Salas, who is the retired U.S. Air Force captain who was one of the seven speaking at the National Press Club, and I'll be talking more with him here in just a few minutes, he sent back an email and said, this is just like the old code that we ran into at the missile bases before. When they talk about pings and noise surges, he said, Linda, it doesn't make sense with what Boeing said about the missiles all being independent. And in the last 24 hours, there has been an even stranger statement coming from the Air Force saying that they never launched the ability to control the missiles. That's impossible if they lost all communication ability and all 50 were taken offline. So we're not really getting a story that is comprehensible yet, and it may be because something of very high strangeness occurred yet again at Warren last weekend. But the exact cause of the failure of the and having to take those 50 offline still remains unknown. ICBMs have also gone down in the visible presence of UFOs at American air bases responsible for our nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles. And one of those missile sites is Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls, Montana, north of Helena and about 100 miles south of the Canadian border that Bob Salas has talked so much about. Well, Malmstrom is one of three U.S. Air Force bases that maintains and operates now in the modern age 450 Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles, and they are stored at Malmstrom Air Force Base underground, Warren Air Force Base near Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Minot Air Force Base in Minot, North Dakota. When you look at a map, as I have it at earthfiles.com, you will see that those three locations form an almost perfect triangle. 43 years ago, on March 16, 1967, at Malmstrom Air Force Base, the Echo flight crew was 60 feet underground in the Flight Launch Control Center that was located about 90 miles east of Great Falls. And to everyone's astonishment, large reddish-orange glowing aerial disks were seen by the security alert team. And simultaneously, 10 Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missiles started going offline, one at a time, every second in some reports. That meant 10 of America's most secure military weapons 60 feet underground had been controlled and shut down by a force from above ground. And then, incredibly, the same thing happened 8 days later on March 24, 1967, to Oscar flight. 10 more ICBMs were shut down one at a time every second, is some reports. One of the U.S. Air Force personnel in a missile bunker 60 feet underground was First Lieutenant then Robert Salas, who had graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1964. While in the U.S. Air Force, Bob Salas received his master's degree in aerospace engineering in 1969. By April 1971, he received an honorable discharge as a U.S. Air Force captain, and he went to work for Martin Marietta and Rockwell International as an aerospace engineer working on space shuttle proposals. Then in 1974, Bob Salas was hired by the Federal Aviation Administration in aircraft certification and aircraft structures and worked as a structural engineer for aircraft until 1995. Since retirement from the FAA, Bob has taught high school mathematics in Ojai, California, and tutors students in math. On September 27th, at the National Press Club in Washington, Bob joined six other witnesses to the Echo and Oscar flight shutdowns in a presentation that he had organized with UFO investigator Robert Hastings. They want the press and the public to know that it is not true when the U.S. government authorities say there never was a UFO threat to national security, then or now. And here is retired U.S. Air Force Captain Robert Salas.
We're all saying things that are directly in conflict with what the Air Force has claimed these many years, and that is that no UFO incident has ever impacted national security. That's patently false. It's a lie. It's just an outright lie. And so we've got a confrontation now between us and the Air Force.
And no one from the government off the record has ever approached you to say, keep your mouth shut.
I think they tried to keep my mouth shut. In 1969, I was transferred to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to finish up my master's degree, and not long after I arrived, I was ordered to go to the base psychiatrist's office. I didn't know why, but I went ahead and went to the hospital. Base psychiatrist's orderly came out and wanted me to talk to the psychiatrist. I asked him what reason was I called in. I didn't complain about anything. He said, well, the base psychiatrist will let you know that. And I said, no, I'm not going to go back and talk to him about anything because I knew that it would go on my record. Later, the orderly comes out and they released me. I suspect that they wanted to hear my UFO story so they could put it on the record. That's the closest I got to where they put pressure on me to keep my mouth shut.
If you had talked to the psychiatrist, they would be able to hold that over you as a question of your credibility for the rest of your career and life.
That's correct.
Did anybody in the U.S. Air Force or any other agency say, this is why we have to keep this under wraps?
No. No one ever talked to me about this. After the next morning, when I was debriefed in my squadron commander's office, and we were told to sign a non-disclosure statement, which I did, we were told never to talk about it again. And nobody ever talked to us about it again, and we never spoke about it until 1994.
But did you ask back in 1967, why are we being asked to sign non-disclosure agreements about something as significant as this?
I certainly did. My commander, first question I asked him when I walked into his office, I said, was this some kind of an Air Force exercise? And he said, absolutely not. And then the guy from AFOSI just said, sign here, and we will never speak of this again. I even wanted to know why I should sign anything, because I had above top secret clearance already. But he said, no, this specific incident, you have to sign this.
And the AFOSI agent standing next to him, he wasn't going to allow you to have any dialogue about this. It was sign this non-disclosure if you want to have a career?
Exactly. In fact, a day or two, maybe a week later, one or two of the guards called me at home and wanted to sit down and talk to me. They were very upset with this whole thing. They couldn't understand it. And I had to turn him down. I said, we can't talk about it. You know, I've signed this non-disclosure thing, and I can't talk about it again.
Did you know then at the time that you all were dealing with something from outer space that was not human?
Absolutely, we knew it. These were not aircraft. We even discussed this in a first phone conversation I had with the guards. They assured me these were not airplanes. So they knew they were something from elsewhere.
And in fact, on March 16th, 1967, one of the Echo Flight security policemen, and I'm quoting from your 1999 summary of all of this, and you reported, one of the security policemen was so affected by this encounter with one of these big red glowing objects in the sky that he never again returned to missile security duty, close quote.
That's true. In fact, that happened not only at Echo, but at Oscar Flight. I know of at least one case where one of the security guards lost control of himself and wandered off. Now, they had to bring people out to pick him up and take him out to the base hospital. I mean, he was just out of it.
And how were the SAT team describing what they were seeing?
It was a reddish, orange, pulsating object. It was about 30 feet in diameter, and it was just sitting there. He had all the guards out there with their weapons out, and he was frightened, very frightened.
You were getting these descriptions down underground about how deep?
Yeah, I was 60 feet underground. We were locked in. We were obligated to stay there until we were relieved by another crew, obviously because we were in control of 10 nuclear weapons.
The Boeing investigators concluded, and this is reading from your 1999 summary, quote, to reproduce the effects on the ICBMs that went down, a 10-volt pulse would have to be introduced into the data line. How did they reach that conclusion?
One of the Boeing engineers, Mr. Reigert, did a bench test on the guidance and control package. We got information when the missiles went down that we had guidance and control system failure and logic coupler failure. The logic coupler is part of the computer system that helps orient the missile in flight on target. So I think he did a bench test. In other words, he had the equipment on a bench and input a certain signal at a certain wavelength and was able to shut the system down. We have an Air Force document stating that this signal, they use the generic term of EMP or electromagnetic pulse, would have to have been an external signal. So this is one of the conclusions the Boeing investigative team came to. The internal system could not have generated such a signal. And they also said that all the missiles were independent. This signal would have had to have been sent to each missile separately. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
These missiles are about a mile and a half from the launch control center where I was located. There was buried cable that was triply shielded underground, about 60 feet underground. So this EMP signal would have had to have been injected into each of the missiles separately, go through triply shielded cable, and sent to a specific point at each missile.
And your own summary says, quote, the technology of 1967 made generating an electromagnetic pulse of sufficient magnitude to enter the shielded system a very difficult proposition requiring large, heavy, bulky equipment. The source of the pulse that caused the missile shutdowns remains a mystery to this day, unquote.
Right. And that's why Boeing concluded that they could find no reasonable cause for this. They could not explain it. They couldn't understand it.
Again, quoting from you, the U.S. Air Force has confirmed that all of Echo Flight's missiles shut down within seconds of each other and that no cause for this could be found, close quote. How could they maintain that no reported UFO incident has ever affected national security?
Exactly. Exactly my point. That's why we have a standoff here with the Air Force. It's a contradiction. They cannot, on the one hand, say that they can't explain how these missiles went down within seconds of each other, and on the other hand, say that national security was not involved. I mean, they're talking out of both sides of their mouths.
Well, as we speak on October 12, 2010, what in your mind today could explain a policy of denial in the interest of national security being maintained and persisting after 60 years?
The only way I can explain it is that there is a very influential small group of individuals within the government and also maybe outside government that are controlling this information, keeping it from presidents and are just not inclined to release it for their own reasons. It's high time it stopped. It's got to stop. The public needs to be involved in this conversation.
If we are dealing with a non-human intelligence that has the ability to take down ICBMs in a fashion that Boeing at the time said was impossible, what is your perception now about that intelligence and what its agenda might be on this planet?
Well, yes, quite a bit of time has passed since 1967, and nothing terrible from extraterrestrials, I don't think, has occurred. I go back to my original contention that this was simply a message that they were pointing to our nuclear weapons, basically saying you ought to get rid of these things. They will do you no good. And it is gratifying to me to see that we're moving forward on a new SALT treaty with Russia, trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons. But we've got a long way to go. We've got to figure out a way of having strong inspections of all countries and having all countries start dismantling all nuclear weapons. That's the objective.
And Bob, isn't another part of the message in 1967? You think that you have the ability to launch these missiles, and we're here to tell you we will interfere and stop it.
They do have the technology to shut down our missiles, no question about it. But will they stop a nuclear war? I don't know that I want to risk that. I'd rather us get rid of our nuclear weapons and preclude a nuclear war.
So, George, this is very powerful stuff in the light
phenomenal
of 20-some, going all the way back to 67, and it didn't begin or end there. What is remarkable is when you do research about what is now available in history of UFOs interacting at American missile sites, you find a list like this, and this is not all of it. August 1, 1965, Warren Air Force Base, Cheyenne, Wyoming. August 24 to 25, 1966, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. March 5, 1967, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. That was just before the March 16th and March 24th events at Malmstrom. So there were three events at two bases in March of 1967. June 6, 1968, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. This is where guards reported that some of the security was standing motionless like statues, as if their bodies were under someone else's control, and they were reporting UFOs right above the Minot, North Dakota Air Force Base missiles, and something had happened to the security guards. And on October 24, 1968, Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, and I know from my own brother, November 1975. It's another big story that happened at Malmstrom. And Bob Salas, in trying to help the public and the media hear their testimonies from the National Press Club and see the transcripts of those testimonies, has both a website and a Facebook link at www.spiralgalaxy.org. That's www.spiralgalaxy.org. And you can listen to the seven testimonies at the National Press Club from September, and you can see the transcripts. And when you look at this whole body of work, George, all these years, how can the fingers be kept in the policy of denial died?
I know it. Up next, we're going to talk about some animal mutilations. It gets a little graphic. Let me warn you. We'll be back.